This is Audible.
William Morrow and Harper Audio present Firestorm, a novel by Taylor Moore, performed by Jeremy Arthur. Cowboy is a way of life that transcends race, creed, color, and gender. It's the wildest of spirits, the purest of hearts, and the gentlest of souls. Cowboy is dogged determination, a job done right, and a fight won against all odds. Cowboy is what the world needs a little bit more of these days. It is to those rare few that I dedicate this novel. Part 1. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of lions. Daniel, chapter 6, verse 22. 1. Garrett Cole had spent the better part of his DEA and special operations career taking a series of calculated risks, but he'd never done anything quite as stupid as this. Blasting across the lake through the foggy darkness in a Super Aeronautique G-25 Paragon, he pondered everything that could go wrong, which was a hell of a lot to consider in a place run by the Garza cartel. With the sudden thought of slamming into a limestone jetty at 35 knots, Garrett yanked the throttle, killed the motor, and let the wake boat drift to a lazy stop. With no wind, the stagnant, fishy air hung heavy like a soggy sponge. It was a smell that normally put this avid angler in the best of moods, but tonight, there was simply way too much at stake. As a seasoned combat veteran for the U.S. Army's 10th Special Forces Group, Garrett was no stranger to being behind enemy lines, but this rendition assignment with his task force partners in the Texas Rangers and CIA had jacked the pucker factor up to 11. Breaking more international laws than he cared to count, Garrett shoved those thoughts to the back of his mind and focused on something he could control, finding the drug lord they were supposed to meet. Garrett raised out of his seat and glanced up at the moon and stars, which had pierced the clouds and bathed the shoreline of thick carrizo cane in a soft, amber glow. Lifting the 4X night vision binoculars to his eyes, he panned the reed-covered beach in the green glow of his optics, spotting a dry creek bed about 50 yards out. But for a prowling bobcat and an overturned John boat, there was really nothing to see. No pier, no fishing village, and no murderous cartel boss with a duffel bag full of cash. Looking down at his map, Garrett clicked on a penlight and aimed the beam at the upper right corner. According to his GPS, they were right where they were supposed to be, an isolated cove near an old rural community called Rancho Culebra. The plan was for him and his mission accomplice, Texas Ranger Cade Malik, to meet up with their confidential informant, CI, Ray Smitty, and a drug kingpin named Emilio Garza. Had he not been in dangerous country on assignment, Garrett would have longed to explore the area around Lake Amistad. The 65,000-acre body of water on the Rio Grande was a desert oasis, with rugged terrain not unlike the arid ranchland where he grew up on the Texas High Plains. It was tabletop flat in places and scarred by deep ravines and jagged cliffs in others, wild, remote, and lonesome. Just the kind of land he loved. Garrett eased back into the driver's seat and looked around. More fisher than skier. He wouldn't have traded his own Skeeter bass boat for the Nautique, but it was perfect cover for two ne'er-do-well ranchers out looking to make a deal with the devil. According to their fabricated backstory, Garrett and his brother, played by Malik, had a penchant for whiskey, wild women, and worldly possessions. Despite having a hangar full of vintage muscle cars and a fleet of helicopters they used for hunting feral hogs, their entertainment cup was sadly only half full. They'd burned through a chunk of their daddy's oil fortune, and as a result, the old man had put his foot down. Despite giving them an allowance fit for a Saudi sheik, they wanted more, and they wanted it however they could get it. Garrett only hoped Garza didn't notice that he and Malik looked nothing alike. The ranger was tall and lanky, a short-shorn towhead, while Garrett was just below 6 feet, with long dark hair, a bronzed complexion, and athletic build. But whatever similarities they lacked in looks, they made up for in banter. The ball breaking between the two came off as natural, as if they'd been tormenting each other since the playpen. Malik, wearing a burnt palm cowboy hat and coyote-colored hunting shirt, was sitting up on the bow, keeping a close watch on the dark horizon.
Hell of a good night for fishing, ain't it?
Good as it gets. Garrett gave a nod. Quiet, too. But for the occasional small wave lapping against the hull, it was dead silent.
Probably got a few minutes until showtime if you want to throw in a line.
Malik gave a slow shake of his head as he scanned the shoreline.
Don't think I'd enjoy it too much given what we got on our plate.
The ranger sounded a bit anxious, and Garrett knew why. Aside from the obvious danger, the operation to capture a Mexican drug lord was an opportunity of a lifetime. It could make or break their careers. Of course, that was assuming they weren't killed in the process.
This thing will be done before you know it.
Garrett let out an easy chuckle.
Hell, I lay you odds we'll all be having margaritas over in Del Rio before noon.
Malik swiveled around.
Think so, huh?
Damn sure hope so. As a former Green Beret, Garrett never took odds on high-risk operations. Too many variables. Also, it was bad luck. He'd cussed more than his share of soldiers for doing just that. But Garrett needed Malik calm and collected, so he doubled down on the lie.
Oh yeah, I can taste the huevos rancheros, pinto beans, and corn tortillas right now.
Malik shot a glare.
Corn, did you say?
Disgusted, he turned back and raised his binoculars.
Knew something was off about you, Cole.
Feeling as though he was living out the lyrics of a Lyle Lovett song, Garrett had to laugh. Apparently, Malik was a flour tortilla man. For some Texans, that was a personal conviction of the highest sort. Garrett was about to connect his partner's dislike of sweet tea to latent communist leanings when the ranger perked up. Malik lowered his voice.
See some lights up there.
He pointed to a spot about 100 yards west where there was a break in the fog.
Think that's the village?
Garrett turned the key in the ignition, and the 600-horsepower motor rumbled to life. He clicked the throttle forward, and the motor grumbled into a grind. As they eased through the mist, he followed the halogen lights to a rusted gas pump where a couple of turquoise rowboats were tied to the rickety pier. Behind the dock were 5 cinder block shacks. The ragged curtains danced in the windows, making the place look more haunted than abandoned. Knowing it'd be a great setup for a cartel ambush, Garrett reached back to secure the Nighthawk double agent pistol tucked into the back of his belt. He'd swapped his DEA-issued Glock 17 for the 1911 before the cross-border trip. Deep cover officers are all about the details, and carrying his service weapon just wouldn't do. It was the same reason he'd altered his appearance from rodeo rogue to well-to-do land baron. The shift in disguise had required a barber visit and a slight trim to his thick beard, taking him from ruffian to rancher in a matter of minutes. But Garrett didn't hide the sleeve tattoos of death skulls, tomahawks, and screaming Comanche warriors atop galloping Mustangs. With his faded Wranglers, twisted ex-moccasins, and untucked Howler Brothers pearl snap, his look fell somewhere between cowboy and frat boy. Garrett turned his black Lone Star dry goods trucker hat backward, raised up in his seat, and took in the village. Other than the wafting stench of fish guts from the pier and some freshly burnt trash, there were no signs of human activity. He nosed the Nautique up to the dock, yanked back on the throttle, and drifted up to the far end beneath a halo of yellow lamplight. Malik reached for the gnarled wood piling that jutted up from the planks and brought the wakeboat to a halt. After tethering it to the dock, he turned back.
Right on time, and exactly where we're supposed to be.
The ranger's voice still held a nervous edge.
But something doesn't feel right.
Garrett felt the same, but wasn't going to give in to any bad juju. At least not until he had a good reason.
Remember, man, we're holding a good hand of cards here. Garza wouldn't take the risk to meet us in person otherwise. So, just play it easy. And play it loose. Like a couple of drunk bubbas about to spend $10 million on trashy women, Caribbean fishing trips, and big game hunts in Alaska. Got it?
Malik, a confirmed bachelor and avid outdoorsman, seemed to drink in the idea.
Already there, man.
The toothpick in the corner of his mouth raised with his wide grin. Although Garrett hated to admit it, he was a little nervy too. For the first time in a long time, he had a lot to lose. And most of it had to do with an orphan from Afghanistan he'd brought home to the ranch on a protective custody assignment. Garrett thought of the boy as his own son and wanted to adopt him, but all those plans were hinged on repaying a debt to the CIA. In exchange for covering up past transgressions, Garrett was conscripted as an off-the-books black bag operator, and his first assignment began with the cross-border snatch-and-grab involving Garza, who had become public enemy number one after torturing and murdering a Texas Ranger and sending a hit team after Garrett's own family. Tempted to get riled at the thought of it, he kept calm by going over his cover story, poking any holes yet to be poked. And the biggest hole out there was their CI Smitty, a two-time loser in the Texas prison system and a low-level crook who had started running drugs for Garza. Smitty could either rat out the drug lord or spend the rest of his life in prison. Despite his shortcomings, which were many, the former convict had a brilliant scheme. His idea was to lure Garza into a meeting with two brothers, Garrett and Malik, who owned a large ranch contiguous to Mexico. But the land itself wasn't the real draw. It was the gas pipeline crossing the border that got the drug lord's attention. Smitty had devised a plan to use what was known in the energy industry as a pig, a maintenance device that travels the length of pipelines for cleaning and inspection. Retrofitted, they'd been used in the past to transport drugs and cash. If there was a better way to smuggle contraband across the border, Garrett had yet to see it. At the sound of an inbound motor, Garrett turned, just as he heard the uh-oh from Malik. Through a break in the mist, he saw two sets of lights, which meant Garza had broken the deal and brought his thugs along for the meeting. Garrett and his partner might be holding a good hand, but the drug lord had stacked the deck. And worst of all, the whole damn operation hinged on Smitty, who wasn't even a joker. He was the Uno card that had somehow slipped into the box. 2. Ray Smitty surveyed the lake's dark shoreline, careful to avoid the drug lord's suspicious glare. Emilio Garza wasn't just known for killing those who crossed him. He was known for sending a distinct and unsettling message, usually written in blood. As their 550-horsepower Pavati wakeboat moved through a dewy fog, Smitty cursed himself for agreeing to an operation in this borderland graveyard just south of the Rio Grande. Agreeing to it, hell, it had been his stupid idea. Knowing what he knew now, prison would have been a much smarter choice. The problem was that Smitty didn't make smart choices. He made foolish choices. Drunk choices. Choices based on fear. And the greatest fear of them all, right up there with being skinned alive by Garza, was what would happen to his daughter if he messed up again. His darling girl had made many a prison visit to the Wynn unit over in Huntsville, but she was just a tot back then. Savannah was just shy of middle school now, a young woman in her formative years. These were ones she'd remember, the ones he couldn't miss. Between inheriting her mother's good looks and his bird dog sense for finding mischief, Smitty knew she'd be a magnet for the wrong sort, the sort like him. If he was going to keep her from falling into that trap, then he had to stay clean. He had to be home. In other words, he had to be a father. Smitty had been out of trouble for a while now, but the trouble with trouble was that it was damn near everywhere. The deal he was making with Garza was his do-over, a chance to make things right after all his misdeeds. Of course, prison was a better alternative than what would happen if things went wrong, and they were about to go wrong. That was for certain. Smitty turned to Garza and gave an easy smile. Wearing a white guayabera and tan linen chinos, the cartel head looked nothing like the short and pudgy Pablo Escobar or Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. Garza was tall and slender, with sharp features and a handsome face. He could have passed for any run-of-the-mill successful Latin American businessman, were it not for his sullen eyes, permanently fixed in a psychotic glare. Smitty knew better than to judge anyone by their looks. His whole damn life he'd been accused of looking like a weasel. Of course, favoring a musky rodent might have had nothing to do with a gosh darn thing. His mother-in-law looked like a slutty Martha Stewart but couldn't cook a Pop-Tart. Sometimes crap just looks like stuff. Finishing up whatever he was texting, Garza brushed the dark hair from his eyes and slipped the phone into his shirt pocket.
Good news for you, Ray. Your friends are here.
The report told Smitty one very important and frightening thing. Garza's spies were out there watching.
Told you to trust me, didn't I?
Smitty faked a laugh that came out nervous, blowing any effort he'd made to cover his fear.
Knew they'd be right on time. No doubt.
Garza pulled his Cabot Diablo 1911 from the glove box and tucked it in the front of his belt. Made of Damascus steel and forged with pieces of an old meteorite, the silver and black pistol looked more like a work of art than a functioning firearm. But Smitty had seen the drug lord use the .45 semi-automatic before, at close range. It was as deadly as it was beautiful. Garza's brazen display of the weapon was his way of letting their new business partners know this was no ordinary kind of deal. Of course, that should have been evident by the machine gun-toting bodyguards in the Supra SA-550 wakeboat, trailing not far behind. Having lost trust in his Mexican sicarios, Garza had contracted a new team of mercenaries made up of members of Guatemala's elite special operations forces, known as Caibiles. What they lacked in resources, they made up for, in an inventiveness born of poverty and jungle hardship. These cutthroat killers were short and stocky, strong as oxen, built like their indigenous ancestors. They operated on raw instinct and an animalistic will to survive. Smitty scanned the beach ahead through breaks in the low-level clouds settling atop the lake, searching for help, which he'd been assured by Garrett and Malik was out there. He fought to keep from squirming, knowing that the drug lord was studying his every move. A bad vibe from Garza was as good as a bullet to the head. The Pavati's motor dulled to a rumble as they drew near to the dilapidated wooden pier in front of the village. As the boat drifted beneath a ring of lamplight, Malik took the rope from the Kabila gunman, who'd moved from the driver's seat to the front. The ranger tied it to the cleat of the Nautique and brought both boats side by side. Smitty couldn't help but admire Garrett's coolness under pressure. Despite the mercenaries, he didn't make a fuss. He just dug around in his cooler, pulled out a Tecate, and tossed the can to the bodyguard, who nearly lost his balance trying to catch it. The Kaibile was confused but content, cold cerveza in hand and a smile on his face. A brilliant move by the undercover agent. Garrett bellowed out a greeting like a drunken college kid.
Una chela muy fría, amigo.
Smitty rose from his seat, following the drug lord's lead, and trailed him the few feet to the bow. Garza waved off the confused guard who stepped back to the boat's controls, still wearing a baffled grin, wondering what the hell he was supposed to do with his beer. Not missing a beat, Garrett tossed another Tecate to Garza, who fortunately seemed amused by the antics. No doubt the cartel boss was more accustomed to cowering than bravado. But Garrett had made sure Smitty built these traits into their profiles. The drug lord knew to expect two drunk buffoons, arrogant and clueless, as they were greedy. Not to be outdone in coolness under pressure, Garza cracked his Tecate, blew off the suds and took a sip. He raised it and smiled. Salud. Smitty didn't know much Spanish, but he knew the toast could mean to health, wealth, or security. He prayed for all three, but knew it was for naught. Neither Garrett nor Malik would call off the mission, even when targeted by a boat full of mercenaries. Garrett polished off what was left of his own beer, crushed the can, and tossed it onto the pier with a clank. He opened a fresh one, popped up, and took a couple of faux stumbling steps to join Malik at the front of the boat. Garrett reached to Garza to help him aboard.
Welcome, my friend. Step on in.
He thumbed over his shoulder where the maps were laid out on the table.
Got everything set up already. Overlay of the pipeline, schematics for the pigging device, all you need for making lots and lots of money.
Garza left Garrett's arm hanging, took another sip, and looked around, just as Garrett had done.
Why don't you join me first?
Garrett looked over both shoulders and shot Garza a skeptical glare.
Bit risky, ain't it?
He let out a drunk-sounding chuckle.
Thinking them federales you got down here would love to get their hands on a couple of gringos.
Garza shook off the notion.
You're in my world now.
He tilted his head toward a bottle of Herradura Selección Suprema on the table.
To celebrate our partnership.
Garrett looked a little antsy, and Smitty didn't blame him. The drug lord had already broken the deal by bringing his entourage of Guatemalan commandos. Before Garrett could make another argument, Garza added,
I insist.
He draped his arm around Smitty's neck and pulled him close.
I'd like to get to know the people I'm doing business with first.
Although the gesture was meant to look like a warm embrace, Smitty knew it was a warning, and Garrett was aware of that too. The drug lord's offer was not to be refused.
That's the good stuff, man.
Malik looked to Garrett like a kid brother begging for permission.
Can't turn down Suprema, can we?
An awkward moment passed as Garza stared Garrett down. The tension in the air hung as thick as the humidity, and Smitty suddenly became very aware of the gunman in the boat 30 yards off their stern. They were out of the light, but he could see the rifles and their silhouettes. Garrett turned his death glare on Malik.
Guess not.
He held out his hand to be helped to the other side. Garza clasped Garrett's hand and pulled him over into the Pavati. As he moved wobbly to the back of the boat, the Texas Ranger leapt over next. Once secured, Malik moved to the stern where Garrett was already sitting with his back to the open water. He had downed his second Tecate in preparation for the good stuff and helped himself to a sloshing shot of the Herradura. It was a ballsy move, but right in character. Looking as though Garza might have bought into the lawman's ruse, Smitty let out a sigh of relief, hopefully not too loud. He'd just begun to feel like things might be okay when the cartel boss drew the pistol from his waistband and aimed it at Garrett. 3. Terrence Tripp Davis of the Texas Ranger Reconnaissance Team scanned the 5 little cinder block shacks of the fishing village through the green glow of his night vision goggles. Since Garza had already welched on the deal by toting along a boatload full of heavily armed bodyguards, Tripp expected it wouldn't be the drug lord's only surprise. The good news was that the mist had lifted, giving him a better view. The bad news was that he still couldn't see much. His view of Garrett was blocked by the henchman Supra, which was floating behind Garza's boat. Blind to what was going down on the other side, Tripp shifted focus to the perimeter, now bathed in light from the full moon and stars. The petite blonde beside him turned and asked again, "See anything?" She had her own night vision binoculars, but they were of lesser quality than the Steiner scope fixed to Tripp's Daniel Defense M4V7 rifle. He took another hard look, but came up empty.
"Sorry, no dice."
"What's the range?" she pressed.
"Same as the last time." Tripp pretended to recalculate, then let loose his answer in a Texas drawl, smooth and easy as his temperament.
"About 200 yards.
He turned to Kim, who had taken a knee beside him, her binoculars trained on the boats across the cove. As a combat veteran from 5th Special Forces Group, Tripp had seen a few strange things, but nothing compared to this. The hush-hush mission into Mexico was out of the ordinary, but the attractive blonde beside him with the suppressed H&K MP7 submachine gun took the cake. Kim Manning couldn't have weighed more than a sack of sugar, but she was a heavyweight in authority. He didn't know exactly who this was, but she had CIA written all over her. This wasn't the first shadow war that Tripp had been roped into by Garrett. Back in Afghanistan, his old buddy had recruited him into a mountain warfare unit that hunted terrorists on horseback. As the only snuff-dipping, pickup-driving black cowboy in the bunch, he was a bit of a rarity, but so was his skill set. He was a superb rider and a hell of a good shot. After the Army, Tripp became a state trooper and was selected to be a Texas Ranger. He joined the SWAT team, completed the precision rifle program, then later moved on to Ranger Recon, conducting intelligence gathering and drug interdiction on the Mexican border. He'd worked a couple of task force operations with the feds, but nothing this high level. For this mission, he ditched his badge, ID, and normal attire, which typically fell somewhere between cowboy and commando, Stetson, blue jeans, and an Under Armour polo. But for their weaponry, which they could dump if need be, anyone they encountered would suspect them as a couple of lost campers who'd gotten themselves in a whole lot of trouble. Tripp moved from prone to a knee, slid a couple feet right, and repositioned against a stack of red Spanish tile inside of an old adobe structure that looked like the Alamo. He snatched a brittle blade of dry grass from a crack in the floor, let it loose, and watched it drift in the breeze.
"Wind's kicking up out of the west."
Tripp raised his rifle and rested the crosshairs on the head of a Garza gunman.
"Turn that boat a smidge, and maybe we can see Garrett."
Kim nodded.
"Okay, well, at least that's good news."
"Yeah, but there's something else."
Tripp debated whether to mention the bad news.
Kim turned, looking anxious.
"Now what?"
He pointed to the wave of mist floating over the village.
"Fog's rolling back in."
"Damn it."
Kim raised her binoculars for another scan of the area. Tripp kept his scope trained on the boat flanking Garrett. There were 4 stocky gunmen on board, all carrying Tavor X-95s, a strange but deadly choice of weapon for cartel henchmen. Assuming the bullpup rifles were select fire and not commercial-grade variants, each shooter could unload a 30-round mag in 10 seconds. Garrett and Malik would be dead in about 2.
What do you think?
Kim looked to Tripp.
Got a shot?
Tripp didn't mind pulling the trigger on some cartel dirtbags, but he was a law enforcement officer, not an assassin. He'd not be afforded the same immunities as Kim. Aside from that, there were friendlies behind the target. His stray round was no better than one from Garza. Given Kim's casualness with taking preemptive lethal measures, it assured his suspicions that she was CIA. Only the agency operated under a kill-first, sorted-out-later mentality. Tripp needed to slow this thing down before it got out of hand.
I got 4 good shots, but soon as I pull the trigger, so will they. And Garza won't hang around. He'll haul ass once the bullets start flying.
Kim didn't miss a beat.
Take him out first, then.
Oh, hell. This thing was going down right here and now.
Tripp kept the crosshairs on the gunman furthest to the left, the only one who had his Tavor shouldered and pointed at the Pavati. With the center of his reticle on the henchman's spine, Tripp did his best to get a read on their body language, trying to determine if they were in a standoff. Then suddenly, a solid gust spun the gunman's boat just enough to reveal that Garza was pointing his pistol at Garrett. Tripp rested the pad of his finger on the trigger, sat the crosshairs on the drug lord's chest, and held his breath. He was just about to fire when the fog dropped like a curtain, settled over the boat, and his target was lost in the dewy haze. 4. Garrett wasn't all that surprised to see the gun. He'd looked down the barrel of more than a few, but they'd always belonged to a young hothead, just trying to get in his bluff. Garza, however, was no dope-slinging rookie or someone who wasted time with theatrics. The mission wasn't just compromised. They were about to be executed on the spot. With his pulse racing, heart pounding, the words of Garrett's old mentor from the DEA came to mind. Joe Bob Dawson likened the rapid adrenaline-fueled thump of the heart to a war drum, a signal that your primal instincts were kicking in to help you survive. It was no doubt a psychological trick, a way to keep calm in life-and-death situations, but for Garrett, it was just what he needed, right when he needed it. His muscles twitched, vision grew sharper, and hearing became keener, so keen that the crackle of gunfire from across the cove immediately registered that Tripp and Kim had been found. Garza donned a victorious smile.
I would ask who you work for, but I suspect it will take a while to get to the truth.
You're right about that.
Garrett allowed himself to sink in his seat, trying to get his head below the gunwale in case Tripp had a shot.
But I'm up for the challenge if you are.
Garrett's swagger was purely for show, knowing that the interrogation and tortures would be a fate worse than death. But he needed some time to think. Garza gave a nod to his guard in the driver's seat, then turned back to Garrett and smiled.
Challenge accepted.
A turn of a key, and the Pavati's powerful motor rumbled to life and idled in a low growl. Without even a shred of an escape plan, Garrett glanced at Malik and Smitty, both of whom had lost any pretense of an easy disposition. In a matter of minutes, they'd be deep in the heart of cartel country, without any hope of rescue. Despite the snap of supersonic rounds strafing overhead from whoever was attacking from behind, Tripp kept his eye on the target, or at least where he suspected it to be behind the drifting haze. He had just cursed the damn-ass fog when another gust of wind parted the mist and gave him a clear line of sight. Setting his crosshairs on a gunman, he notified Kim that he'd acquired a target, to which she responded with the two-word command, send it. No sooner had the words left her mouth than Tripp squeezed the trigger, his suppressed rifle coughed, and a 5.56 round whapped the gunman in his sights with such force that he went headfirst into the lake. With the water still rippling, Tripp eased his crosshairs a sliver to the one on the right turning to fire. But before the guard could get off a single round, Tripp bound him dead center of his reticle and sunk 2 bullets in his chest. Tripp lined up on a third, who had good enough sense to try and duck for cover, took 3 rapid shots, and hoped for the best. His last round clipped the top of the gunman's scalp, which popped up a spray of dark crimson. It wasn't by any stretch a good hit, but he'd take good enough so long as it knocked the guy out of action. Tripp ducked when a bullet zipped past his ear and slammed the adobe wall he was using for cover. He had just wiped the debris from his eyes and risen to search for Garrett when he lost visibility in the drifting mist. With Kim now at the back of the room in a full-on gun battle, Tripp ducked low, moved next to her behind a crumbling adobe wall, and joined the fight. She was leaning around the left edge, letting rip with her H&K, emptying one magazine after the next. Tripp thought she was wasting ammo until he eased around the corner and saw the half-dozen muzzle flashes bursting from the brush cover of the mesquite, only 30 yards out. Garrett rushed the driver behind the boat's controls, but hit the deck with a thud as the slack in the line caught with a sudden jerk. Scrabbling to a knee, Garrett turned to the Supra, finding only one of the four guards were left. Even under fire, Tripp had done some damn good shooting. The barrel of the last guard's Tavor was hanging over the starboard side, gliding from right to left, hungry for a target. As the machine gun rattled to life, Garrett hit the deck and the gunwale above him was shredded to kindling. The boat driver took three rounds in the back and slumped forward, his dead weight on the throttle forcing the motor into a furious growl. Looking to the bow, Garrett saw that Garza, who was straddling Malik, had clamped down on the Ranger's throat. Punching and kicking fruitlessly to free himself from the drug lord's grip, his veins bulged and his face grew redder with each missed breath. Garrett lunged for the ignition, killed the motor, and scurried to Malik, crawling beneath a hail of bullets that ripped the boat's interior. Chin so low it scraped the deck, he clambered to the cartel boss, grabbed his pants legs, and yanked like hell. Malik broke loose, landed a solid right hook to Garza's jaw, and leaned against the inner hull, gasping for air. The punch-drunk cartel head turned a bit wobbly and set his unfocused gaze on Garrett, seemingly in shock at the sudden turn of the tables. Garrett yanked his Nighthawk and aimed at Garza.
"Don't move."
He looked to Malik, who was struggling to breathe.
"Sit tight, partner. We got one still out there."
Lying flat as a pancake to avoid the next barrage, Garrett turned in every direction to locate Smitty, but the only other person aboard was the dead driver. With their CI missing in action, Garrett turned again to Malik.
"Where's our friend?"
"Overboard,"
Malik barked out.
"Damn."
Garrett's heart sank.
"Hit?"
Malik shrugged, still huffing.
"Don't know."
Garrett eyed Garza, still dazed and woozy, then turned back to Malik.
"Got your pistol?"
The Ranger reached back and pulled his FN-509 from his jeans and aimed it at Garza. With the cartel boss covered, Garrett turned his thoughts on the last gunman. If Smitty was overboard, he had to go in and get him. He hated to think the poor guy was bleeding out in the water. Garrett was contemplating his next move when he heard the crack-crack of a pistol, the full auto discharge of a Tavor, then a sudden splash. Easing up over the side, Garrett searched for the last gunman, but found no one left. The guard's boat was unmanned and drifting away. Scrambling to his feet, Garrett moved to each side of the boat in search of Smitty, but found nothing but the blackness of the empty water. With the rest of his life to play the what-if game on Smitty, Garrett raced to the bow to unfurl the line from the cleat. Garrett turned to Malik and threw him a zip tie that had been stuffed in his back pocket. The Ranger labored to his feet and delivered a solid kick to Garza's chin, knocking him on his back and out like a light. Malik flipped the cartel boss over and shackled his wrists. He looked across the cove to where the gun battle was raging.
"We need to get over there."
"I'll worry about them."
Garrett leapt back into his Nautique, dashed to the controls and threw himself into the driver's seat.
"Get him back to our side before his reinforcements arrive. We'll be right behind you."
Expecting an argument out of Malik, Garrett cranked the motor, turned the wheel, and jammed his palm on the throttle. Although he could no longer hear the gunshots over the boat's snarl, he could still see muzzle flashes on the shoreline. His friends were in a fight for their lives. 5. Tripp drew back inside the doorframe and threw his back against the wall. Dropping a spent mag that banged on the concrete, he yanked the last one from his chest rig and jammed it into his rifle. A quick pop of the bolt release put him back in action. He had just swung around to fire when a spray of rounds clipped the edge and sent him reeling for cover. A moment to regroup and Tripp hung his rifle around the corner, finding more than a dozen muzzle flashes in the darkness. He braced his rifle barrel against the doorframe, rolled onto his offset red dot, and rested it on the forehead of a gunman crouched behind a pile of bricks. Tripp pulled the trigger, sunk the target, and slid left, locking onto the next. Downing the gunman, Tripp scanned right, spying three fighters maneuvering through the thick mesquite brush around the side of the structure. He snapped his rifle onto the first in line and fired, then moved to the next, who had just collapsed with a double tap from Kim. Another popped up from behind a rock wall and swung his Tavor in their direction, but Tripp's red dot was already hovering over the gunman's right eye. A squeeze of the trigger, a jar of the head, and the fighter's body sank behind the barrier. With another flurry of rounds that sent him scurrying for cover, Tripp took a quick glance back at the lake to find Garrett's Nautique zooming up. He nudged Kim, who was still firing through the window, and got a reaction that was somewhere between pissed and desperate. But before he could suggest retreat, the blonde spy was already tearing a path toward the boat. With rounds cracking overhead and chipping the adobe walls all around him, Tripp hung his rifle around the ledge to provide cover fire, landing another round on a charging gunman. But where one went down, two took their place. He and Kim were about to be overrun. Within 30 yards of the beach, Garrett jerked back on the throttle, but he was way too late. The Nautique slammed into the limestone with an ugly crunch beneath the hull. Sucking in a breath, he found his footing and sprinted to the front. From the muzzle flashes coming from in and around the building, the fighters were closing in fast. Garrett had just raised his Nighthawk and banged out three rounds when a volley of lead zipped and buzzed overhead. He ducked behind the bow and shot into the darkness, where the enemy were fanning into an arc, returning fire from covered positions behind the thick brush. As Kim made a running leap into the front of the boat with Tripp on her heels, Garrett jumped into the driver's seat, jerked the lever in reverse, and heard the flustered whine of the revving motor. A flurry of rounds cracked above, then clack, clack, clacked into the boat's hardtop roof, churning the plastic into brittle shards that rained down on Garrett's head. Tripp scrambled to his feet, raced to the bow, and leapt over the side to free the boat from the bank. With a few sudden jolts, the Nautique rocked back and forth until the sickly drone of the motor morphed to a low, steady rumble, scraping across the limestone back into the lake. Garrett yelled to his friend over the echoing gunfire, "We're good, Tripp." When he got no reply, he called again, "We're good. Let's get." Kim's eyes met Garrett's with a mutual recognition that his friend might be down. Garrett shouted again, surprised by hearing the uncertainty in his own voice. "Come on, man. Now or never." Before Garrett could move, Kim had already dropped her MP7, dashed to the front, and hopped overboard. With the supersonic snap of strafing rounds, he ducked and raced to the front as bullets ripped through the console and shattered the controls. Garrett leaned over, reached out to Kim, who was struggling to keep Tripp's head above water, but couldn't meet her outstretched hand. He leaned further and had just clasped her hand as bullets raked the port side, devouring the fiberglass from bow to stern. Palming the gunwale, Garrett threw his legs over the side, hurled himself into waist-deep water, and moved behind the hull, which had drifted parallel to the beach. He and Kim hauled an unconscious Tripp back behind the boat, taking shelter from rounds that churned the black water. Thumbing the catch-release button, Garrett dropped the spent mag into the lake, yanked a fresh one from his belt, and jammed it into the Nighthawk. Looking back at the lights of the fishing village 200 yards across the cove, Garrett hit the slide release to chamber around and turned to Kim. "You gotta swim for it. Get out of here, while you still can." She looked out at the dark expanse, then back to Garrett.
"There's no way. I can barely keep him afloat standing here. We drown."
"Not him. Just you."
"I'm not leaving him."
Kim's eyes went fiery.
"Or you. Forget it."
"It's the only way."
Garrett grabbed hold of Tripp's lifeless body from Kim and pulled him close.
"Maybe you can get us some help."
The notion was almost laughable. Most Mexican law enforcement officers were bought and paid for by the cartel. They'd be no use. But there were still a few good Samaritans out there, the kind who remember what life was like before their home was run by cartel outlaws. Kim eyed the fish camp.
"You see anyone over there?"
Garrett shook his head.
"There's a dirt road coming in from behind the village. Leads to a little town about 7 miles south. Find somebody you trust that will get you back to the border."
"Somebody I trust?"
Kim's skeptical glare revealed what Garrett believed to be true. Trusting anyone in cartel country would be a risk, but it was a hell of a lot better than staying behind. She pointed at the boat.
Help me back in. We've got Tripp's gun and my own. We can...
How much ammo?
Garrett interrupted, unsure why he bothered to ask. The boat was zeroed in. Any attempt to retrieve the guns would be met with a hail of lead. Before she could answer, a rifle barrel swung around the hull. The guard had just opened fire when Garrett leveled his pistol and cracked off a round, clipping the gunman's shoulder and ripping out a hunk of flesh. His second shot landed center mass, which sent their attacker sprawling. The splash gave way to a lull in the gunfire and an eerie, unsettling silence.
6.
Smitty was still clutching the drug lord's Cabot Diablo pistol when he eased into the driver's seat of the Supra. Now presumed dead, there was strong temptation to skedaddle into the night and disappear forever. But that was the old Ray Smitty. The new one had made a commitment to his wife, a promise to be the husband and father he should have been from day one. With the knock of gunfire echoing across the water, Smitty yanked the night vision binoculars from the guard he'd just shot and panned the dark shoreline on the other side of the cove. In the green glow of his optics, he saw Garrett, Kim, and Tripp huddled behind the Nautique, with a dozen or so men from the hit squad swarming in around them. Smitty had fulfilled his obligation to bring in Garza to the meeting, which met his terms of the deal. Nobody would have blamed him for escaping. The problem was that he'd come to think of Garrett as a friend, even if the feeling wasn't mutual. But it didn't take much pondering to know what the DEA agent would do if the shoe was on the other foot. Slipping into the seat, Smitty flipped the ignition and the Supra's 575-horsepower motor roared to life. With a boat full of dead Kybiles, he stuffed the Cabot pistol into the back of his blue jeans, turned the wheel, and aimed toward the fight. With the throttle jammed forward, it took only a few seconds to cross the cove, but it felt like a lifetime as he watched Garza's gunmen surround the Nautique. Roaring in from behind, Smitty tried to keep Garrett's boat between him and the swarming hit squad, but almost immediately, their bullets were thwacking his hull. Spending the last of his last rounds providing security for Kim as she climbed into Smitty's boat, Garrett holstered his Nighthawk and waded up to the swim platform of the Supra. With bullets popping and chopping the black water all around them, Garrett groaned as he heaved Tripp's soaking wet body onto the deck. Once secured, he clambered up himself and collapsed atop Tripp, shielding his friend from the lead barrage. Nearly slipping off the back when Smitty hit the throttle, Garrett felt his shirt catch as Kim grabbed his sleeve. He took her hand off of the Tavor rifle, racked the slide, and ripped away full auto at the gunmen in their wake. It was less of a defensive move and more of a middle finger to the enemy. But burning through a 30-round magazine had never felt so good.
7.
Cole Ranch, Texas High Plains. Asadi Salim brushed the dust from his jeans as he approached a colt that Garrett had come to call Grizz, short for grizzly, because of the thick winter coat that made him look like a bear. The animal had shed the hair by early summer, but the nickname stuck. Despite his relatively sweet personality and having been under a saddle for 90 days, the sorrel had woken up a bit humpy that morning and gotten the best of Asadi with an unexpected buck. A little dazed and disoriented from the fall, Asadi searched the top rail of the round pen to where Butch sat coaching. The old man lifted the straw resistol from his head, wiped his brow, and ran an open palm over his thick white hair. He always did that when solving a problem. Asadi wasn't hurt from the fall, nor was he afraid of the horse, although he didn't favor the idea of taking another tumble. His only worry was letting Butch down. Disappointing him or Garrett was always the first thing on his mind. Butch called to him in his gravelly voice.
Ease up, sonny. Slow but steady. Let him see your determination.
Asadi turned from Butch to the horse, then back again, clearly at a loss given the unfamiliar five-syllable word. Butch clarified.
Let him know you ain't putting up with no crap.
That, Asadi understood. He gave a quick nod, making a mental note. Determination means no crap. With middle school approaching at the end of August, he had to get his vocabulary up to speed, and he had to do it fast. Asadi approached Grizz cautiously enough not to spook him, but briskly enough to convince Butch, not the colt, he was unafraid. Among the many things to be learned since his arrival in Texas was the cowboy code. The rules weren't written or spoken, but rather lived out during everyday life. It wasn't wrong to be afraid, only to be ruled by fear. But conquering it was easier said than done.
"Hey, outlaw," Butch beckoned with a big wave. "Come visit a minute."
Thankful for the reprieve, Asadi walked over to where the old man was perched atop the fence. Behind him and their little white farmhouse, an orange fireball of sun filled the sky, burning a blurry mirage on the horizon of the flat, dusty plains. Butch noticed it too.
"Beautiful now, but it's gonna be a scorcher."
Asadi agreed with a nod and practiced his English with a topic of conversation that seemed to dominate all others between Garrett and his father.
"No rain?"
Butch shook his head.
"Afraid not."
He patted the top rail with a leather-gloved hand.
"Come have a seat."
Asadi scaled the fence, sat beside Butch, and stared back at Grizz since he knew that would be a topic of conversation. He was desperately worried he was failing at his job. Butch rested his hand on Asadi's skinny shoulder and gave it a squeeze.
"A horse can talk, you know."
With his English lacking at times, Asadi wondered if he'd heard correctly. He looked to Butch curiously to confirm.
"You say horse talk?"
"Better believe it, sonny."
Butch turned to Asadi to make sure he could see his smile. He spoke a little slower, as he often did when he wanted to drive home a point.
"Not like you and me, and not like they talk to each other."
He took a moment to study Grizz.
"But they speak with their bodies, their eyes, and their ears."
"Ears?"
Asadi repeated with suspicion.
"Just look."
Butch pointed at the colt.
"Where are they pointed?"
Asadi jabbed a thumb into his chest.
"At me?"
"Exactly."
Butch's voice went from gravel to gravy when he talked to or about horses.
"He's looking right at you. And do you know why?"
Asadi shook his head.
"Maybe he angry."
Butch coughed out a laugh.
"No way. Not at all. No, he's looking at you because he doesn't want you to give up on him. And he's worried you might quit."
Asadi looked to Butch, certain the old man was joking.
"How you know?"
"By doing exactly what we're doing right now, time and time again, for one. But even more importantly, I have a God-given gift to understand animals in a way most folks don't."
Asadi's face screwed together.
"You be serious?"
"Better believe it."
Butch smiled.
"You see, in the Bible it says God gave animals to us, but I think it's the other way round. I think God gave us to them."
He scanned the length of the top of the Caprock cliffs behind the corral.
"People forget that we were all partners once, back before the apple and everything got all messed up. Since then, it's been a battle of wills between man and beast."
Asadi turned to Butch.
"Like what?"
"Yeah. One only to be rivaled by the one between husband and wife."
Butch winked at Asadi.
"But that's a lesson for another day."
Asadi was confused, and his face must have showed it.
"You say, Grizz own me?"
"In a way, I suppose." Butch shrugged. "You see, my point is that for him to be at his best in this world, he needs a partner, and so do you."
Thinking he understood, Asadi gave a timid response.
"He won't be my partner?"
"Exactly. Like two best friends who work together for a purpose, for something they love, something bigger than themselves."
Butch thumbed back at the hayfield.
"Like taking care of this ranch here."
Asadi looked from Grizz to Butch.
"Like you and me?"
Butch mussed Asadi's hair.
"You know, if my own kids had been bright as you, I'd have had a lot more."
He pointed to Grizz.
"What can you tell about his eyes?"
After careful study, Asadi found them different than he expected. They weren't fierce or blazing. They were nervous.
"He afeard?"
Butch gave a slow nod.
"Yep. Might be a little afraid."
He turned back to Asadi.
and I think the reason is that he doesn't want to let you down.
Finding that hard to believe, Asadi shot Butch a skeptical glare. Still, though, he could relate. The last thing he wanted to do was disappoint Butch.
Me?
Asadi looked to Grizz, whose body spoke volumes. With that in mind, he relaxed, climbed down from the fence, and eased to the colt with the confidence of a friend coming to help. After a gentle stroke across Grizz's neck, Asadi took hold of the reins near the bit and slid the toe of his boot into the stirrup. And with this new understanding, the language gap between horse and rider started to fade. Asadi and his colt, partners. And they were both on their way to being their very best in this world. 8. Garrett fought heavy eyelids, destined to clamp shut. His sleepless night, coupled with the effects of a second margarita, was a recipe for some solid sack time. But there were toasts to be made, and there was no better place for he and Kim to make them than Memo's restaurant in Del Rio. Most notable of their triumphs was the fact that Tripp suffered only a concussion. The tough-as-nails bull rider had taken a back full of lead while pushing them off the shore. Fortunately, the body armor saved his life, but it had done nothing to cushion the blow when he'd banged his head against the boat hull. Had it been anyone else, the injury would have warranted a lifetime of teasing. But Tripp was the guy with the biggest smile and an encouraging word, the one you could count on through thick and thin. Garrett would carry their secret to the grave. While Garza's extradition hadn't gone down exactly as planned, a win was still a win. They'd all be celebrating this one for a very long time. Of course, all the accolades would fall to the Texas Rangers, and more specifically their intrepid, albeit sketchy, CI. Garrett couldn't help but shake his head and laugh at the debt of gratitude he owed a redneck yokel like Ray Smitty, who turned out to be their guardian angel. Kim raised her glass in a toast.
To bringing a murderer to justice.
Her voice was low enough that no one around them could hear. Memo's patrons were a bit more accustomed to small town locals than narco hunters, so it was probably best to keep a low profile. Garrett couldn't help but think that Kim looked a bit girlish and innocent right then and there. It was a rare look for the no-nonsense CIA operations officer he'd met in Afghanistan. Whether decked out in 5'11 tactical garb or her Hermes business suits, Kim was a hell of a smoke show. But there was something about that white Mexican dress with the embroidered flowers and off-the-shoulder neckline that took her beauty to the next level. A quick sip of her margarita and Kim asked,
Bother you at all that the Rangers will get the press on this one?
Got to be honest. It's going to hurt a little seeing Garza do the perp walk with no DEA around. But I'm just glad it's done.
Garrett gulped some ice water, still thirsty from the night's adventures.
How about you? You're the one who really got the wheels in motion.
Whenever CIA makes the news, it's rarely a good thing.
Kim chuckled.
And at the end of the day, the people who matter will know. I'll get the credit where it counts.
Garrett had learned over time not to ask questions about the people to whom she was referring. He assumed they were her higher-ups at the agency, maybe even a few at the National Security Council, someone with direct access to the president. It was wishful thinking, but Garrett had to ask.
So I'm off the hook after this, right?
Kim smiled.
Not by a long shot, cowboy.
Then what's next on this list? I'm ready to even up the ledger.
Doesn't work that way.
Kim seemed to enjoy watching him squirm.
But you already knew that, didn't you?
In fact, he did know that. But Garrett was growing tired of the uncertainty, particularly when it came to the Afghan boy he wanted to adopt.
When do we make this Asadi thing permanent?
Kim's joy seemed to fade.
Still working on that one.
What's there to work on? With the Taliban back at the helm, there's no way in hell we could ever send him back. Should be a done deal.
Ceding the country to the enemy had been a bitter pill for Garrett to swallow, but nothing could be done about it now. The past was the past, and the focus of his future was giving Asadi a permanent home with a family who loves him. There was no looking back. Kim put her margarita on the table and stared at it.
I'm afraid there's a complication.
Complication?
Garrett swirled his finger in the air as if waving a magic wand. Just do that presto changeo CIA thing you do and make it happen. Kim looked up slowly.
Turns out Asadi has family over there.
So what?
It was a knee-jerk reaction, but Garrett felt it to his core.
Afghanistan isn't even remotely safe, especially for him. You know that better than I do.
No, not in Afghanistan. Across the border from his village.
Pakistan.
This revelation shocked Garrett even more.
Where in Pakistan?
Kim paused again, clearly reluctant to deliver the news.
Waziristan.
Garrett's blood boiled.
You kidding me? That's in the heart of Taliban country.
Working to control his temper, he lowered his voice.
Just as bad as sending him home. Maybe worse.
Not anymore,
Kim argued.
Taliban has moved back across the border. Waziristan would be safe for him now.
But we'd be sending him to the people who sheltered our enemies, gave them food, clothing, weapons. They're just as bad as any terrorist in my book.
They weren't helping our enemies, Garrett. They were helping other Pashtuns, other Muslims, historical allies.
Same thing, Kim. No matter how you want to spin it, those people have blood on their hands. My blood, my friend's blood. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda may have moved out of there, but nothing's really changed. They hate us, and they'll hate Asadi too.
Kim sighed.
Look, the situation is complex.
Not to me, Garrett shot back. After testifying against the Taliban butchers who razed his village, you can't tell me there won't be people looking for Asadi to get revenge. People who probably came from the exact part of that country. Sending him back would be a death sentence.
He'd be protected,
Kim argued.
How can you be sure of that?
Kim let out a huff.
His uncle is very powerful. A man of influence.
Uncle? What uncle?
Garrett's distrust of the CIA was in overdrive. Work with them long enough, and you start to get a feel for when you're not getting the whole story, which was most of the time.
Everyone in his village was murdered, and Asadi never mentioned any other family.
Well, he's a distant uncle. Asadi doesn't know him, or his aunt and cousins. But they're there, I promise you. I checked them out personally.
And?
Now Kim looked exasperated.
And what?
What makes his uncle uniquely qualified to keep Asadi safe?
Kim looked around the way intelligence officers do before dishing out the goods.
His uncle is a tribal chief.
You mean a warlord, Garrett corrected.
Whatever you want to call him, he's highly respected. No one crosses Omar Zadran. Not the Taliban, not Al-Qaeda, not even Pakistani intelligence. He's very well connected. Nobody goes against him, ever.
How can you be so sure? You've seen how these guys horse trade. How do you know this Zadran won't make a deal with the Taliban? Swap Asadi for someone he really wants?
Because we know, Garrett.
How do you know?
Because we've known him for a long time. We're working on a deal.
And there it is.
Asadi's uncle was a CIA asset, or at least someone willing to cooperate. But it didn't mean he was kind or moral, or that he would be decent to Asadi. It meant he was getting something from the U.S. in return. Usually that was weapons or money. Sometimes both.
Okay, Kim. What do you have cooking over in Waziristan that is so important you would ruin the life of an innocent 11-year-old boy?
Kim shook her head.
I can't get into that.
Garrett bristled.
Well, you better give me something, because I ain't letting him go if he's going to be a pawn in some kind of damn CIA shadow war.
Kim looked around again, clearly uncomfortable with the conversation.
Look, you know as well as I do, we need to know what's happening in Afghanistan. Through Zadran and his extensive contacts, we have a window into that world, a window we desperately need. Now that the Pakistani government has thrown their support to the Taliban, we have less support in the region than ever. Zadran even has ties to ISI. He's our eyes and ears now.
The Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI, is Pakistan's primary intelligence agency, known to play both sides of the war on terror. After the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan, Islamabad's fig leaf didn't just drift away. It was blown with the force of a hurricane. Of course, what could you expect from the country that was hiding Osama bin Laden? Garrett could tell she was holding back.
You've got something up your sleeve. I can tell.
Kim lowered her voice.
You've heard about over-the-horizon operations, right?
OTH, among other things, was the concept of using surrogates in places that the U.S. military and intelligence community were denied access. Garrett was doubtful if it would work effectively in Afghanistan, which mostly had to do with the failure to detect the attacks planned for September 11, 2001. As an undercover operative, he was a big believer in boots on the ground. Garrett shook his head.
Don't tell me you've bought into all that crap.
I don't make policy, I just do my job to the best of my ability.
And this is your job now?
Garrett guffawed.
Armchair intelligence gathering.
Zadron is the poster boy for OTH, and it's my job to make sure it works.
Garrett knew it wasn't easy for Kim to reveal that information, and he understood why the deal with Zadron was so important. But it did nothing to assure him of the boy's safety.
Okay. I appreciate your honesty, and I trust your judgment. I know you care for Asadi and would never suggest a solution that would put him in harm's way. But he's never even met these people. They're strangers.
I know, Garrett. But you always knew this day could come. You said it yourself. You'd support him going back if he has family there.
Garrett had said those very words and meant them. But that was months ago. That was before he realized he could never let the boy go.
Maybe they don't even want him. I mean, if they knew Asadi had a good home, that he was happy here, maybe Zadron would...
Kim shook her head.
Not how they think over there. All goes back to Pashtun Wali. It's their code of loyalty. Zadron believes he has a duty to tend to his family's orphan child, and there is no changing that. It's been their way of life for millennia.
Garrett raised his hands, palms up beside him.
Doesn't Asadi get a say in this?
Kim looked genuinely pained.
He's a child, and his family wants him back.
Garrett started to speak, then stopped himself. Kim sat staring at him, clearly not ready to let it go.
Got something to say? Then say it.
If you leave us no choice, then maybe Asadi and I will go another way.
There is no other way.
Garrett shrugged.
We'll see.
Kim leaned forward and looked around to make sure no one was listening, then asked with gritted teeth,
You mean you'd kidnap him?
It's not kidnapping if it's your own damn son.
Yes, it is still kidnapping, and he's not your son.
Garrett shook his head, frustrated over the fact that legally she was right.
He's not my boy, officially, not yet. But I'm all he's got now.
Kim let out a long sigh as her eyes went from fierce to forgiving.
I know it hurts, but we always knew
this was a possibility. Garrett finished. Yeah, I remember. All I'm saying is that if what you're suggesting is how it plays out, then maybe there's another option.
Taking off with Asadi is not an option.
Kim's words had a tone of both frustration and pain.
This is coming straight from the CIA director, who is talking with the deputy director of national security. They see Zadron as a foothold in an area of extreme importance to the safety of our country. And they're not going to let that go over a kid.
Garrett wondered if he should just shut up and do what was necessary if the time comes.
Okay, maybe you're right. We'll just wait and see then.
It was clear by the look on Kim's face that she wasn't buying his sudden change of heart.
We will find you, Garrett. We will track you down no matter where you go. You know that.
I've got no doubt you can find almost anyone in the world if you've got a mind to. But the day I go off the grid will be the last time you ever see me again. Or him.
Garrett's boast was no bluster. In Army Special Forces, he'd been trained by some of the best in the world to evade and survive in the harshest conditions known to man. And given his role as a deep-cover narcotics officer, he'd learned how to operate beneath the radar, develop new identities, and live undetected. If it came to that, he and Asadi would be ghosts.
Even if that is true, then what, Garrett?
Then we make a new life.
Kim was clearly anguished.
And what kind of life would Asadi have as a fugitive? No home, no school, no stability. You'd be looking over your shoulders every moment for the rest of your lives.
Before Garrett could respond, she pressed on.
Look, just don't do anything rash. Let me work things from my end. And then if it's time for drastic measures, we'll talk.
Kim's reasoned and rational argument had bested his emotional half-cocked plan. It was all true. Life on the run is no life at all, which meant the CIA operative had to find an alternative. She might be a magician, but she wasn't a miracle worker. Even Kim had her limits. 9. Garrett yawned and rubbed weary eyes, nearing the end of his 12-hour drive home with Tripp from the border. They made a pit stop at Perini Ranch Steakhouse in Buffalo Gap, the meal on Garrett, of course, then swung through Abilene. Slipping past Sweetwater, home of the world-famous Rattlesnake Roundup, the duo shot through Post, named for C.W. Post, the breakfast cereal manufacturer, who founded the town in 1906 to create his own utopian society. From there, they'd continued to Lubbock, and then north to Amarillo, playing a soundtrack made up of regional music legends like Buddy Holly, Bob Wills, and Waylon Jennings. The stretch of highway that had taken them from the Rio Grande to the Canadian River ranged from desert to prairie,